Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and it is October 10th, 2016. Now, as we enter the late stages of the third massive central bank-inspired bubble in 15 years, there are precious few voices that have been steadfastly pointing out along the way just how idiotic all of this really is. Did I say third bubble? I meant global interconnected set of interlocking bubbles, because that's really where we are. We have a stock bubble, a bond bubble, we've got real estate bubbles, everything that you would expect when you expand central bank balance sheets by tens of trillions of dollars. Today, to discuss macroeconomics, real estate, bubble dynamics, debts, deficits, is someone I've been reading for years, Wolf Richter, proprietor of WolfStreet.com. Wolf lives in San Francisco. He's got over 20 years of C-level operations experience, including turnarounds and a VC-funded startup. He has a BA, an MBA, and an MBA. Hey, Wolf, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me.
It's a real pleasure. I've really been looking forward to having you on. And I love knowing how somebody got to where they are. So can you just give us your quick backstory? What did you do before you began writing for your internet audience?
Well, I was in business my entire life, so running different kinds of companies. And so most recently, but that was already a while ago, I was doing the startup in Belgium. That was 2002, 2006, that time period, and a telecom startup. And I had to travel a lot to the United States. And this is where the idea first got kicked off that I needed to do something different where I published my insights, because every time I came to the United States, I saw just completely obvious signs of a housing bubble. So in 2005, for example, I remember that moment so vividly. I was sitting at an airport waiting, and there's this young woman next to me talking on her cell phone. She was flipping condos that she hadn't even seen in an airport that you couldn't go see because she had a 9-to-5 job, and I thought, this is insane. You know, this is going to blow up. That was 2005. Yeah, and things just got worse. We had money in a closed-end bond fund and an open-end bond fund, and one of those money market equivalent bond funds, a big one, a huge one, and the mortgage-backed securities started to show up in some of the data, and the 10 biggest positions it had were mortgage-backed securities, and I got really worried. The cracks were starting to appear in the banks, you know. And so we took all our money out. Now, a month later, the bond fund started dropping. It eventually lost 60% of its value before they took it off the internet, and it turned into a massive series of class action lawsuits and all kinds of other things. But you could not read a thing about the stuff in the mainstream media. You know? So there's bubble after bubble, burst after burst, and the media does not pick up on it. And that's the underlying theme here. And I thought, good grief, you know, I'm seeing this with my own eyes, but I'm not reading about it. Now, what's wrong? Why was I able to get out of this bond fund, and other people that didn't know and that didn't see what I saw weren't able to get out of it, were able to get out, but too late, and they lost a huge amount of money. And so then we had the financial crisis and the bailouts, and I was talking to my wife about all of these things. I was furious. And the legalized corruption at the Fed, corporate America, in Congress, in banking, you know, it was just terrible. And how people just creamed off at the top, you know, and there's a Fed audit and this kind of things, you know. And my wife got sick of it. Yeah, she said, don't talk to me about this stuff anymore, you know. And then I decided in 2011 to start my website, and I had a predecessor website. I switched to the new name in 2014. And we've been going gangbuster ever since. It's a passion. I love doing it. There are so many things that I like to write about that are not necessarily in the mainstream media. That's really what I focus on. I focus on financial and economic analysis that's not in your obvious sources. So this has been a great move, and my wife doesn't have to listen to me anymore, and the website's doing great. So wolfstreet.com has been it's growing rapidly. We're going to hit 1 million page views a month here this year. We're very close to it right now. So this has been great to me.
Fantastic, and glad you have your outlet. I had to do the same thing. My wife didn't want to hear me railing against the things I was railing against. But do you remember what was the first thing you wrote about?
Oh gosh, I wrote about very early on. I wrote about the Swiss franc peg. One of my first articles in 2011, first major articles in 2011. I wrote about IBM's what I call the hocus pocus machine. It's short share buybacks and how it uses those to manipulate its earnings. I wrote about those kind of things. I had very few readers at that time, so I think my Swiss article was really the hottest article I had at that time, and it got maybe 200 readers or something.
The early days. Now, would you say that you're writing specifically to counteract maybe some of the cheerleading that happens in the mainstream press, or you know, how do you select the material that catches your eye?
Well, I certainly have been accused of that, and I would proudly admit to that. I don't particularly try to counteract the mainstream press. I just try to give a point of view that you can't see in the mainstream press, so that's very difficult to find in it. I try to give analysis and data that's not obvious. It's not on the front pages. So I use a lot of government data. I use a lot of data that comes out of research organizations, and it's all data-based. I rarely get into rants, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're fun to read, but I try to stick to the data and analysis. So, and it just turns out that right now I'm bearish on a lot of things. So I don't buy the hype. There's a few things I'm bullish on, and I say that. So I'm not a perma bear, but right now I think we have so many problems that have accrued for so long that it's very difficult to be bullish on a lot of things.
Well, let's talk about some of that, and I certainly share that view. I guess, look, if I'm going to neatly encapsulate my view, I just call it bubble economics, right? So I was a huge critic of the Greenspan Fed, and I was a big critic of the Bernanke Fed, and I'm an even larger critic of the Yellen Fed, because I think they're each making mistakes that are compounding on their predecessors, right? And the mistakes are now larger and larger and larger. So, you know, Greenspan, 1994, he was facing a hiccup in the corporate bond market, and he decided to do something. This is geek talk here for people who are listening. Don't let your face hit the soup bowl too hard. Try and break the fall when I talk about this. But he implemented something called the sweeps programs, which basically allowed banks to take demand accounts, sweep them into a fictitious set of accounts just before the stroke of midnight. So when they took their snapshot, they wouldn't have to hold any money in reserve against those accounts because they got swept out of demand accounts into non-demand accounts. And then at 12:01, they got swept back. That was just a little hocus pocus that Greenspan engineered, but it allowed banks to be free from the constrictions of having a reserve requirement, which gave us the money printing spree, which enabled things like pets.com and other things, gave us the dot-com boom. That blew up. Then we got to, you know, what I thought were emergency blowout rates of, you know, Greenspan and then Bernanke bringing us down to 1% gave us a housing bubble. That blew up. And here we are at 0%, and I shudder to think what sort of blow up we're going to get in as a consequence of this little period of history. That's how I see all of this, is sort of through the macro monetary lens of mistakes. How do you view it?
Well, I'm certainly not disagreeing here. I'm on your side on these issues. I think I want to add one more thing about central banks, and I think you sort of touched on it, but each central banker, so the Yellen Fed is going to try to outdo the Bernanke Fed, just like the Bernanke Fed outdid the Greenspan Fed when it comes to handling recessions and crises. So already Yellen mentioned that she wants to get Congress to allow the Fed to buy stocks and corporate bonds. And currently the Fed is not allowed to do that. So she's already preparing the groundwork for doing even more than Bernanke did. So each successive Fed has it seems like a mission to be even more powerful and even bigger in the markets and even more manipulative than the prior one. And that's really concerning, because where do you end up there? And I call it the no exit monetary policies, because, you know, once you get deep into it, there's no good way out. And so I just wanted to add that I think there's a passion among these Fed bankers to outdo the prior generation of Fed bankers.
Now, you spent some time in Japan, which I understand from a book that you've written. To me, they're the poster children for the no exit monetary policies. And now the central bank of the Bank of Japan is amongst the largest shareholders for equities, and they continue this, and they've just recently re-upped their ETF purchase program to slightly more insane levels. And so we're now in this crazy twilight era where central banks, through the magic of printing money out of thin air, will potentially become some of the largest asset holders in the world, with you know, just kind of snuck by most people, that the Federal Reserve is now, through its MBS portfolio, the largest landlord in America by a good chunk. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? To get to that point where central banks are majority holders of real stuff. So speaking of your no exit monetary policy, where does that end?
Yeah, I mean, I was just joking the other day. I wrote an article about declining rents in New York City and in San Francisco, and you know, we've peaked here, and so rents are going down. And I was just joking the other day and saying, you know, the central bank's going to buy stocks and bonds pretty soon, and then, you know, if rents keep dropping below a certain point, it's just going to start renting apartments until rents go up. You know, I mean, or like you said, where's the limit? You know, once you can start buying stocks and bonds, why not rent a bunch of apartments if demand withers, if rents are too high and people can't afford them anymore, you know, and they have to come down? Well, the Fed will prevent them from coming down by renting them, and by buying condos outright. You know, I mean, they're already buying mortgage-backed securities. Why not buy the real estate itself? And so once you get into this mindset that there needs to be more and more tools in the toolbox, as Yellen says, you know, there's really no end what they will end up buying. And there are real consequences for in the economy. This is not, I mean, buying government bonds is one thing, and it creates a bubble, but, you know, people have to live somewhere. So creating a housing bubble has real consequences. It makes life very expensive for a lot of people. And, you know, creating other bubbles sooner or later is a big wealth transfer from those that at the lower levels of society that depend on paying for some of these things, you know, and to those that receive it. And so I think at this point, you have a Fed that's already trying to add tools to its toolbox, because what Bernanke gave Yellen is just not enough, it seems.
Just not enough. Yeah, just throwing trillions into the market. So Wolf, I loved, let's bring this home, because the consequences, I think, are important. I want to talk about this. And yes, if the Federal Reserve, you know, rents apartments to try and keep the prices up, because that's the right thing. Well, it's the right thing for people who are dependent on the rents, but for the renters, that's not the right thing. And this has real consequences. You wrote a great piece a while ago. It was about San Francisco specifically, and I think you focused it around teachers. And what it would take to buy a median house. Just if you could walk us through that example, because I think it's just the absurdity of it, just how unfair this really is, but also how unworkable it really is for people who are even what I would call solidly middle to upper middle class.
Right. Now, San Francisco, we're a little bit special here, you know.
Of course you are.
The numbers are, they seem really crazy to people who live in other parts of the country. But here they're in the Bay Area, they're reality. And San Francisco is not even the most expensive place. Palo Alto and Silicon Valley is a lot more expensive. It's much smaller, so it doesn't usually show up in the statistics. But it's crazy there. And some of the other smaller towns in Silicon Valley are just even more insane. But San Francisco is big, and so we see the numbers. We have... I think the median teacher makes around $65,000 a year here. I mean, forget about buying a house. You know, there's not that many houses in San Francisco. They're very expensive. They're $1.3 million median price, you know, somewhere out in the avenues, far away from everything. You know. So let's talk about apartments. Let's talk about condos. And for a or renting an apartment, I mean, even renting, if you have a salary of $65,000 a year and you're looking at a one-bedroom apartment, nothing fancy, just a median one-bedroom apartment that rents for $3,400 a month, that's about $40,000, a little over $40,000 in rent a year. So so you pay taxes on your $65,000 in salary and Social Security and so forth, and I don't think teachers pay Social Security, but whatever they're paying in their pension funds, and then you have practically nothing left to beyond rent, you know. So you forget buying groceries, forget buying clothes. I mean, this is it. So you have to pack two people, two teachers, a two-teacher couple, into a one-bedroom, into a median one-bedroom apartment. And that'll barely work financially. Yeah, so if you want to raise a family in a one-bedroom, and one-bedrooms in San Francisco are small. I mean, these are tiny places. So and people do that. I mean, this is not uncommon. But this is what we call the housing crisis, when you cannot afford, when the median income cannot afford a median home anymore. You know, so you need to be wealthy to afford a median home. And of course, financially, long term, that doesn't work, because you know, and we have rent control, so people who live in certain buildings that are rent controlled can live there forever and their rents won't go up very much. But buildings that are not rent controlled, yeah, they will evict the tenants and to get or they will raise the rent so much that the tenants have to leave, you know. And so you have the situation where during the middle of the year, a bunch of teachers have to leave San Francisco because the rents went up and they can't afford the new rent. And they have to pack up and leave even the Bay Area. So the school district came up with a rule that I think was finally overturned, but came up with a rule that you couldn't evict teachers during the school year because they were losing teachers during the middle of the school year. Because they couldn't afford to live in San Francisco anymore. I mean, we have the word, the housing crisis. That's how everybody calls it. And it's just, it's insane. You know, you have a stock bubble, and that's fine. You know, if stocks double or triple in price, it doesn't really have an impact on the real economy. Yeah, people don't have to live in these stocks. They don't have to buy them. They don't have to eat them. But when you start talking about housing doubling, the cost of housing doubling in a span of a few years, there you're talking about real life getting so expensive that it's no longer affordable for the lower 80% or so. And you know, I hate to say lower 80%, but that's really what it is. So you know, this is where a housing bubble is very destructive in the real economy. And you walk around San Francisco and you see a lot of little shops closing up because people here are strung out due to housing costs. So they don't have that much money left to go to these little shops and go to the restaurants. Some of the restaurants are doing very well, but others are, you know, obviously they're very, very difficult to manage here. And a lot of shops are closing. You know, there's not a lot of retail given the income levels in San Francisco because we don't have much money left after rent. So this housing crisis is starting to eat up a bigger and bigger part of the economy. And so housing bubbles are treacherous. And when housing bubbles blow up, which they always do, they become even more treacherous. They impact the financial system in some fundamental ways. And they can wreak a lot of havoc. So to create a housing bubble, or as the Fed calls it, to heal the housing market, that's terrible on the way up, and it's terrible on the way down.
Yeah, well, let's talk about healing the housing market, because the mainstream press does a great job of alluding to rising housing prices as being unambiguously good. Like, we should just all cheer. Hey, house prices were up 9%, you know, this last quarter. Right. They all clap for that. But you're talking about there's a housing crisis. Obviously, this comes about when house prices go up too fast and they really stretch and then break people's livability. The other part that usually isn't talked about is that if my house goes up in price, well, sometimes my property taxes fall along with that. Of course, my insurance costs might go up with that. There's a variety of things that just sort of like my house didn't change, But my cost of operating it sure did, right?
Let me throw in something else here. You cannot actually benefit from that increase in home value unless you take equity out of it through a bigger mortgage. Because if you try to sell the house to profit from it, from the home price increase, you're going to have to buy another house at the same inflated price. So all you're doing is paying more real estate commissions and more and finance costs and insurance costs and taxes, as you mentioned. But you cannot benefit from a housing bubble if you're not an investor, but if you're a resident in that home, because you sell it, you get a lot of money for it, and then you have to live somewhere else. And unless you moved from San Francisco to Detroit, yeah, you could benefit. But if you stay in your own neighborhood, you're swapping two assets of the same value. You know, you can't, there's no gain in there.
Absolutely. So let's talk housing bubble from the other side real quick then. You know, recently I've seen some notable rollovers, sales volumes just reported in New York, down 20% on certain apartments. San Francisco seemed to have slowed down a bit in spring. I remember reading some articles in the June sort of time frame that there was a slowdown. London, obviously, Vancouver, off big time. Now, Wolf, are these just signs of a cooling off period, or do you think that we're at the first part of the bubble bursting here?
Well, every housing market is different. Yeah, so it goes by city. And so you look at Houston is the oil bust market, and Houston has a commercial real estate problem that blows everything else off the chart. Yeah, so it's on the commercial side where Houston's really get hit. San Francisco has a condo problem. There's a huge and an apartment problem, a rental problem too. You know, in that sense, you know, because they have built, I don't know how many towers have gone up recently, last few years, and there's tens of thousands of new units coming on the market, and there's 65,000 units in the pipeline. San Francisco isn't that big; it's 800,000 people here, so that has a big impact. So there's an oversupply coming online now. That's what we're feeling on the condo market. So rents are going down. Condos have gone down in price year over year, but house prices are still up. So houses are hot in San Francisco. They're still hot, and they skew the overall numbers. And in the last many years, nobody built a house here. Single-family homes just aren't getting built. This is a city of apartments, so that's what's getting built. And so the average numbers, or the median numbers that include houses and condos, are sort of in the flat area, but the condos are now trending down, and rents are trending down. New York City, like you said, we've already seen declines in rents. We've seen problems in the luxury end, in apartments and elsewhere. Then you have other markets like Seattle that are still booming like crazy. So it's all mixed. The national numbers will start turning when enough local markets have turned that are combined large enough to bring the averages down. And that happens rarely. That happened during the financial crisis, during the housing bust. But rarely does the national average go down because the housing markets are different and they're timed differently. So one may go down for 3 years and one may go up at the same time. So it sort of balances out. But if you're an individual owner, there are already a number of markets in the United States where the bubble is just deflating.
Just deflating. So is this just letting the air out, or do you think there's the sign that there's some sort of an adjustment coming that could be more severe?
Well, I think this will there's no such thing as a plateau in real estate.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's boom and bust in the current environment. And but the bust may not come like in the stock market in a short period. It may be many years, and it may be, declines in the single digits in prices year after year after year. And this is kind of how it happened in Japan. You know, with that, a housing bust that lasted decades. And there was some sharp declines, but a lot of it was just small increments year after year after year, decade after decade, really.
Yeah.
And demographics play a role. There's other things that are important. But, like in San Francisco, these prices are not economically sustainable. You know, you cannot have median homes that require a multimillionaire to live in. because we don't have that many multimillionaires here. You know, so that it kills the prices, kill demand, and that's what we're seeing now, that demand has withered. And so it eventually with housing, you have a real economy that gets in the way. Stock markets can go to insane heights without much resistance. You know, the housing market, there's resistance building up to these high prices because it's just it's just economics. You know, people just don't have that kind of money.
Well, and a lot of this, of course, is due to falling mortgage rates, and a lot of that's due to monetary printing. And so in many respects, that with a lag, the housing market is still subject to the same forces that are driving and underpinning the stock market, which is, will the central banks keep doing what they're going to do? Obviously, lots of people speculating about that. You're focusing on the numbers. I'd love to turn to those numbers. In particular, every time Janet Yellen comes out in an FOMC meeting, she talks about how signs the economy is strengthening. Let's go there, because at the macro level, first off, global trade. What are you seeing in global trade right now?
Global trade is weak. And that has a lot of people concerned. Now the meme is that global trade is weak because the free trade movements have lost strength, and there are barriers to trade now being built up and those kinds of things. And that covers up the real issue, which is demand. And global trade is all about the goods producing economy. So about manufactured goods, about raw materials and so forth, and not about the service economy. And the goods producing economy in the United States, in China, in Europe, has been very weak, in some places has been declining. And so that shows up in global trade. The service economy includes healthcare. Healthcare in the United States is around 18% of GDP. It didn't get there because Americans use more healthcare. It got there because of enormous price increases in pharmaceutical products and other things, and concentration of insurance companies, and those kind of things. You know, so now you have a sector in the economy where there's very little competition that can raise prices at insane rates. And they're starting to eat up more and more of GDP. So there's less money left for other things. And so I think the goods producing economy, which, by the way, also includes pharmaceutical products, which are over 10%, like 12% of total wholesales in the United States, is pharmaceuticals. I mean, it's gotten to that point of insanity there. But there's not that much left for other things. And so in the United States, we see manufacturing output in trouble. Same in China. Some countries, the cheap countries, so-called, they're doing a little bit better. We are having issues in Europe with manufacturing. So, you know, there is no way that trade can look good when the goods-producing economy globally is in bad shape. And so we've had trade numbers that are declining. You know? And so this is a bad sign for the goods-producing economy.
Now, the theory was, you know, starting in 2007, if we just slap another 50, 60 trillion of new debt into the world, we'll get this economy going again. Of course, being over 200 trillion, just debt, not liabilities, but just debt, is a claim saying that, hey, we're expecting rapid growth to return. Isn't there some nervousness out there now that, hey, where is the growth? I know, like Jeremy Grantham said, structurally, we're not going to have growth for a long time. You have a Steve Keen, an economist, saying, of course you're not. Look at the debt levels. But for a variety of reasons, hasn't enough time passed where we can go, wow, we're not seeing the former levels of global growth? And that should be causing some nervousness in the markets that I haven't seen priced into stocks or bonds yet.
Yeah, that's correct. And unfortunately, and I think that was one of the biggest mistakes the central banks made during the financial crisis, they stopped the debt from blowing up. So we never had that cleansing. In a recession, normally you companies deleverage, they go through bankruptcy, they shed their debts, and you have this big wave of debt restructuring. And, you know, this is painful for bondholders and banks, but it clears out the crap that's clogging up the pipeline. And so these companies reemerge or get bought out, and the debt just disappears. Same with consumers, you know, they unload the debts through various methods. And so when the recovery starts, you're not suffocating under this huge load of debt. And that hasn't happened in the United States particularly, but in other countries too. That debt never got fully blown out. So then the recovery started with 0% interest rates and QE, which encouraged companies and individuals and governments to take on even more debt. So now we are burdened with such an enormous amount of debt that I think it's very hard to even breathe for the economy. And I think there are a lot of people out there that are worried about this. And, you know, they're, you hear now voices saying we need a serious reflation. You know, they need to come up with a lot of inflation to wipe out that debt. And, of course, that is a that'll be a fiasco for our economy, because if you have any uptick in inflation without an uptick, an equivalent uptick in wages, which we haven't been getting, then you will destroy the consumer. And so this is not a great solution either. But there, I mean, there, everybody sees that there's too much debt out there, and we're still encouraging, we're still solving the too much debt problem with too much debt. I mean, the Fed's still saying, you know, we'll make money for free, and you just need to borrow more money. And, you know, that's the solution to having too much debt. I mean, it's insane when you look at it. I mean, it's just, of course, the Fed would never use the word insane, but that's, you know, that's what they're doing.
Well, the beatings will continue until morale improves.
That's right.
And if 0% won't do it, how about we lock all your money down, take cash away, and give you negative interest rates, and we'll just set that dial to max pain. What is it, minus 3%, minus 4%? Tell us, what will it take for you to take your money out and go and spend it? As if that was the cure for everything. As if we could just all spend more. And of course, my view, my work in the world is to say, yes, you could possibly goad people into spending more this quarter, and you have a couple of good years maybe, but longer term, where are we going with that story? Because you can't grow infinitely forever. You know, there's some limit to this that has to make sense. And where I get concerned is that the central bank has somehow adopted the dogma that whatever is good for finance and whatever is good for Wall Street is obviously the same thing transitively, what's good for the rest of the country. And it's not really true. And so at some point we're going to have to admit that the tail is wagging the dog. You know, we're growing the financial system simply because that's what it wants, rather than that's right. What we need. And Japan, again, poster child for that. You know, that demographically, I can make a strong case that a very good economic outcome for Japan would be a slightly declining economy over time to match the population, both demographically and aggregate in numbers as well. They should be experiencing deflation. That would be overall good for everybody, but can't have that. They need something else.
Interestingly, about the Japanese economy, and we keep calling it the lost decade, or and how bad the economy is doing. And yeah, they have a rapidly declining working age population, but when it comes to GDP per capita and GDP per working age person, Japan is at the top. Especially GDP per working age person, GDP is by far higher in Japan than in any other developed country. So their economy, given the demographics they have, their economy is cranking. Yeah, it's doing really well. They're working hard and efficient, and so the overall numbers don't look good, because you have, you know, your working age population is shrinking very rapidly and aging rapidly. And the people that are now entering the workforce are not very many. I mean, this is a very small number. And so you have that issue. But in terms of per working age person, their economy is doing really well. And I go there quite a bit. My wife's Japanese, so we have some contact there. And we look at it on an individual basis, and they're doing okay. They do, however, have an enormous fiscal problem, and I don't, you know, I don't think there's anybody in the world that imagines that this somehow can be solved in any way other than monetizing the debt. And I think that's what the central bank is doing. They're just going to keep buying these government bonds until they own. Right now, they, you know, by the end of 2017, they'll own like 50% of it. They'll go to 60%. They'll go to 70% in a couple of years. They will completely control the government bond market to where they will not have a debt crisis. And I think the Japanese are really keen on avoiding chaos. They will have maybe a yen crisis, which is a lot easier to manage than a debt crisis. They will continue to print money, and that will monetize the debt that they have and keep control over it. At the same time, at some point, they will have a major problem with the currency, and that can balance itself out. Now, you know, Japan is an exporter, so they can always get enough hard currency in by exporting. So they will not run out of hard currency to buy materials they need from other countries. So they have a way to manage a yen crisis, which other countries don't have. You know, when their currencies collapse, they get into real trouble. Japan won't have that problem. It will be a huge hit to their national wealth, to the wealth of individuals. But right now, you know, they have this debt that has powered the economy for so long, and now nobody can deal with it anymore other than just monetizing it. So I think that's what they're doing. Regardless of what the central bank is telling us, that's the plan, I think. They're just going to go forward and monetize 70% or 80% of that debt. And so in order to avoid the chaos, the Greek-like chaos that comes with a debt crisis.
Hmm. Well, I've been looking forward to their yen crisis for a long time. I agree. I think that's they will succeed beyond their wildest hopes in debasing the yen at some point. But
at some point, yeah.
Who knows when that comes. So, all right. So if global trade is slowing down, and I love that point you made about how the healthcare is a parasite that's consuming more and more of the economy. So we can detect maybe some of that excess service consumption in less importing that's going on. What's going on with the restaurant industry right now in the U.S.?
Restaurants are a key indicator in an economy for discretionary spending. You know, you don't have to go to a restaurant. You want to go to a restaurant, or it's convenient. Maybe you need to go, but you don't have to. And so we keep our eyes on restaurants for that reason, because it's, number one, it's a big part of the economy. It's about 4% of GDP, about 10% of the jobs in the restaurant industry. So it's big. These are not well-paid jobs, but a lot of people do work in it. And so now we have indications that the industry is really running into hard times. We have restaurant bankruptcies this year of chain restaurants. Yeah, they're just piling up. And, of course, these are all the older chains that have taken on lots of debt with encouragement of the central bank. Mm-hmm. And now the leases are going up and the expenses are going up and sales are going down. And so the only way out is for them to declare bankruptcy. There's, I think, 14 chains that have declared bankruptcy in the last 10 months. That's a lot. I mean, that is as bad or worse than during the financial crisis. We have the restaurant index that's dipped into the negative now. We have the restaurant owners and operators getting bearish on the overall economy. They're usually a pretty optimistic lot. And so now they're seeing in the next 6 months, they're seeing that it's going to get worse rather than better. So the restaurant business is getting hit. The casual dining, fast dining sectors, these are the ones that are particularly under the gun right now. If you own a very well-run, very good, high-end restaurant in San Francisco, you're going, or in other cities, you're probably going to do great. At the upper level of our economy, there's plenty of money and plenty of spending. So these restaurants, you know, can do very, very well. But if you're a restaurant, if you're running a restaurant like a TGI Fridays or Black Eyed Peas or one of those, you know, you're losing your customers. And your customers are you're losing customers for two reasons. Number one, competition. You're not keeping up with it. And number two, people don't have enough money and they're cutting back on restaurant spending.
Right. So this leading indicator says things are falling off a little. So we really do have a very mixed bag of indicators here that collectively don't really point to much super positive. But the thing that's off, that's a little odd to me is, of course, is the equity markets priced in here as if we were, you know, just about to recover like crazy into some new promised land. And I, my only way I can account for that is central bank printing and people speculating that, you know, it's the only reason I would buy Personally, over here, if I was in this country, the only reason I would buy a negative yielding German bond is because I'm thinking it's going to become more negative, right? And if I'm in Germany, I could make a case for, ooh, I have to, I'm a treasurer of a large corporation. I have to keep my money in Deutsche Bank, or over here losing 0.4% a year. I'll do that, because 0.4% is not the same as losing 40%. I'll do that, right? So I can make the case for that. So, but speaking of that German bank, in our time remaining, I would love to Deutsche Bank. Obviously, on a lot of people's minds this past week. By the way, I see equally horrible stock prices for other major money center banks in Europe, but Deutsche Bank is in the news. What do you see there?
Well, obviously, they waited way too long to bail out Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank already raised capital twice since the financial crisis, and it did so when its stock price was still relatively high. And so it sold equity, and it sold these contingent convertible bonds that are similar to equity, and they can be bailed in. They're designed to be bailed in when the bank gets in trouble, so bondholders get a pretty good coupon when things are going well. But when the capital levels drop below a certain level at Deutsche Bank, those cocoa bonds, as we're calling them, are getting bailed in. So the owners may either get equity in return or may get nothing in return. And that's designed that way. And so they've done that twice. Now the cocoa bonds have plunged in value, and the shares have plunged in value, and they can't really, it's very difficult to sell these into the market. I mean, they would have to offer a huge yield to sell these cocoa bonds, and the shares, that have to sell a lot of shares to get a little bit of money. So they've sort of missed a train on this now, and they're needing a lot of money, really. I mean, the fine is just part of it, but a big bank like Deutsche Bank is not going to get tripped up by a fine that's $5, $6, or $8 billion. The damage that Deutsche Bank has on its balance sheet is far bigger than that. So it would have to raise $20, $30, $40 billion, and there's no market there for that. So that's the problem, and the market knows that. And so the market is going to beat up on Deutsche Bank until there's going to be a bailout of some sort. And it will come. I mean, Germany will not let Deutsche Bank collapse like Lehman collapsed. It is way too big. It's way too important for the economy. It's way too important for the global economy. And Deutsche Bank assets are 58% of the amount to about 58% of the GDP in Germany. That's how big it is, $2 trillion in assets. You know, it's gigantic in a country that's not that large. So there's no way they're going to allow Deutsche Bank to collapse. There's also no way that they're going to bail in depositors. So I think those are the unwritten ground rules for bailout here. They may bail in stockholders through an equity offering that the government buys. So the government buys 50% of the Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank may issue lots of shares that are equivalent to 50% of its outstanding shares. So that would be a huge hit dilution for the current stockholders. They will probably bail in some of the cocoa bonds and junior bonds, and that will probably be enough. And so maybe they'll have to put in some more taxpayer money, you know. So I think that's how it will happen. I don't think there will be a cataclysmic collapse of Deutsche Bank. This is just not going to happen.
No, I would agree. I mean, if they did let it happen, they would get the Dunce Award of the Year, because Deutsche Bank's much larger than Lehman at this point, and too systemically important to let go. It would just be a disaster. But of course, politically, it's going to be very hard for the Germans, who've been real stern taskmasters on Greece and saying, oh, no, if your people are committing suicide and thousands of businesses are closing per day and people are actually starving, and we had to do all of that so that you would maybe even sell your airports to other outside investors. You can't hold Greece's feet to the fire like that and then go, oh, yeah, we just got to bail out our own bank, though. So banks over people, that's going to be politically a tough thing to pull off.
Exactly. That's why I think bail-ins are going to be the key. There have to be enough bail-ins to pacify the German public. So if you ruin stockholders and you hit junior bondholders enough, you got to remember, a bank bailout is a bailout of the bondholders. That's really what it is. I mean, that's what we did in the United States. We bailed out the bondholders of all these banks. And so if there's a recognition that, okay, bondholders paid a price, stockholders paid a price, okay, maybe taxpayers will chip in a little bit, but given the fact that stockholders and bondholders paid many, many tens of billions, yeah, they will pacify the German public and other European countries as well, because yeah, that's the issue in Greece. Who pays, you know, and who's getting bailed in, you know? So yeah, and they made bondholders pay the price, and they made some. I think in Cyprus they made some depositors pay the price. So in Germany it won't be depositors, but it will be, there will be a price to, and even then it could cost Merkel the election. I mean, that is kind of I mean, there's a lot of opposition to any kind of bailout of Deutsche Bank in Germany right now. I mean, the media are all over this, and I've seen an article that said, "Who needs Deutsche Bank?" You know, and one of the largest newspaper. And I mean, there's a lot of opposition to this, and Deutsche Bank has turned into a gambling institute. And Germans know that. I mean, it used to be a revered institution until it went off track. You know, just like the U.S. banks. And Germans don't identify with Deutsche Bank anymore. I mean, that is, it's gotten into derivatives, and it's gotten into all kinds of other risky things that are not part of the German vocabulary. So there is sort of a little bit of Schadenfreude in it. And you know, Germans are not really big risk takers. They never really forgave Deutsche Bank for taking all those risks. So I think Merkel will have a hard time negotiating that. But I think she would rather lose the election than watch the German economy go down in flames if Deutsche Bank collapses. So I think that's a trade-off she will make. And if she risks her election, she will not let Deutsche Bank collapse.
Well, thank you for that insight. I agree with that, and you've given a lot of additional things to think about there. So thank you for that. And Wolf, thank you so much for your time today. We could keep going. We didn't even get to the Leaning Tower of San Francisco, which I know people are going to want to hear about. So we'll send them to your website where they can read about it, because if you don't know about the Leaning Tower of San Francisco, you really should. So Wolf, again, your website.
Wolfstreet.com.
Great. And we'll send people there, and congratulations on getting to that 1 million page views a month. And we'll see if we can get it a little higher here. And you're doing great. So keep it up.
Let me do a little comment here. We're almost there. So we're going to reach it. So we haven't quite gotten there yet.
All right. Well, yeah, I want to hear the ringing bell when you get there. So congrats on that, and keep doing it. And I hope to have you back on again sometime.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.